More than 3 months have elapsed since 9 Eskimos departed the mining shack in Cleggmore, Northwest Territories, in search of a medical hibachi, a roll of duct tape, 70 feet of climbing rope, and a dogwood tree. Inside the shack, however, only 10 hours have passed due to the tremendous influence the partially assembled tokamak exerts over the laws of physics. Aldo stares at the window in a transcendental trance, his breathing reduced to exhalations only. The blue-black light filtering through the window creates inverse shadows on the floor that resemble a frieze of frozen fog dogs. A deep, eerie growl below the range of conscious human hearing emanates from one of the wispish canines. In conditioned response, Aldo stands up, opens the door, and peers out of the shack. Jerkinless, his limeade saturated mustache instantly freezes in the 13 weeks worth of accumulated cold. As he absentmindedly forms the Athabascan word for Mesopotamia with his lips, several mouth whiskers crack and break off. Although the upper two-thirds of the nearby radio tower appear normal, notwithstanding the 1954 Hudson wingback parked perpendicular to the pinnacle, the base ripples in gravitational defiance of the rest of the structure, clearly demarking the range of the dismantlement. The onset of Celsian winter has turned the pallor of the landscape from burnt sienna to astrolabe white, and a series of circular tracks surrounding the shack suggests visitors of extraterrestrial origin. The wine cellar entrance is now buried beneath a snow savings and loan, but Aldo can still hear a ghostly keening of parallel fifths. Upon closer scrutiny, he discerns that the sound comes not from subterranean Eskimos, but from the rubber earthworms on the floor of the shack behind him. Caught in a temporal rift by the theory of disputational distortion, they seem to writhe precisely out of phase with the suddenly active fog dogs, creating a macabre pas de vingt deux whose path along the floor, when viewed from below, resembles the outline of a smoldering tweezer.
Pas de tweezer, pas de vingt deux, wow!
Glancing north, Aldo is shocked to discover the crystalline shore of the Beaufort Sea a mere kilomile away, a geographical improbability of insultingly huge proportion. The attendant crop circles, too, had been dragged to within yodeling distance of the shack. Could this topologic anomaly be attributed to the disassembled fusion energy device, or had the limeade concentrate come from citrus fruit imbued with psychotropic properties? A single Eskimo materializes beside the radio tower, two-thirds in focus and holding a large Foodie's Grocery Emporium bag. As he approaches Aldo, his focal point wavers wildly
wavers wildly.
But at last he is close enough to share the same time-space configuration.
Waving wildly.
The two exchange gesticulatory greetings and small cheeses. Then the Eskimo withdraws from the bag a dwarf dogwood tree. Instantly, the mining shack-bound fog dogs commence howling in long-forgotten and forbidden keys that causes the earth around them to convulse. Grabbing his jerkin and adobe hat, Aldo makes the Athabascan sign for skedaddle, which they do. The Eskimo leads the way to the radio tower, which they hurriedly climb. Caught between two argumentative realities, the mining shack begins to slowly ooze into another dimension. The keening from the worms grows louder, more dangerous, and the parallel fifths evolve into minor sixths, tenths, and tritones. At the top of the tower, the two absquatulators jump into the Hudson, lock the doors, and hunker down. Beneath them, the world as they know it ceases to make sense, although the door to the shack manages to maintain a kind of proud rationality unto itself. As the bottom third of the radio tower follows the mining shack and surrounding terra infirma into the unknown, the Eskimo instinctively starts the car and turns on the radio. The only signal he can raise is, oddly enough, a subset of this 128th episode of Calvos and Damien's New Music Bazaar, which had bounced off a distant supernova and now exists in that Clegmore time-space configuration. If only we knew this ahead of time, per tokamakic advice, refrain from uttering Le Flambeau Orient, or at least play a request before really untoward events occur, events which may hopefully be assuaged somewhat by the imminently calming throat tones of Calvos.
Well, gesticulatory greetings and small cheeses to you, too. Gosh, right, it is the Calvos and Damien New Music Bazaar, and that was Fields Amaze for gamelan and microtonal keyboard by Patrick Grant. That's a forthcoming release. You'll be able to pick that up on Silent Treatment CD in a month or so, sent to us directly by the composer, who will be on the show next year. We're going to be dealing with today the kind of insinuation of the electronic technologies into music, and not in the most obvious ways, but some of the more subtle ways in which they've made their appearance over the past quarter century. Our guest today at 3 p.m. is David Berriman, who is one of the pioneers in that field, not frequently recorded, and we'll mention that just before we actually speak to him and find out what the implications of that are. In the meantime, here's a piece from the Society for Electroacoustic Music in the United States from their 1995 CD, Volume 4. This is called Scrub Reverse by Mark Edward Gibbons.
Scrub Reverse. That's music by Mark Edward Gibbons for amplified violin, interactive electronics, and tape. You know, it wasn't so long ago that when you talked about electronics, you weren't talking about commercial keyboards and delay devices and all sorts of effects devices that you bought off the shelf. But you were talking about stuff you built. And we'll hear some of that today, but the process goes on. It is not one where the homemade equipment has been given up forever. An interesting composer in that regard is Nicholas Collins. And we've heard all of his recent releases. And let's hear again this for a modified compact disc player in the background, where he can control interactively the chord progressions from an existing recording, in this case an existing recording of music by Torelli. And along with that, a through-composed bit for string quartet. So here, a modified compact disc player and the Soldier String Quartet playing Nicholas Collins' piece, Broken Light. Nicholas Collins, the last movement, Torelli from Broken Light, that's the Soldier String Quartet, with Modified Compact Disc Player. In another approach to this do-it-yourself is the question of computers, and sometimes people built them, and sometimes they used unique pieces of equipment, and in another situation, they had to create their own language to do what they wanted to do. And one of those people is Larry Polansky, and he and some others created a language called the Hierarchical Musical Specification Language, HMSL. And here's a performance from 1990 of Bereshit, music by Larry Polansky with two live computers and the language HMSL and Jody Diamond on the voice. And it's quite an amazing piece, and it's full length. We'll hear the last 5 minutes. Here it is, music by Larry Polansky, Bereshit. Bereshit, Cantillation Study Number 1 in the beginning. Voice of Jody Diamond, the music of Larry Polansky. So a little homemade CD player work there with Collins and a little bit of homemade language with Larry Polansky. The use of electronics can be traced back quite a ways. You could say that the use of a phonograph during a concert performance to play bird calls constitutes that. One of the first pieces is John Cage's 1939 Imaginary Landscape Number 1, which includes a part for variable speed turntable. So it really goes back quite a ways. One of the pioneers in the use of computer technology, specifically small computer technology, was David Behrman, whose use of the Kim 1, for those of you who may or may not recall, the Kim 1 from the mid-1970s was a computer based on the 6502 microprocessor, and that was what was used in the early Apple computers. Only it had 1K, that's 1K, 1024 bytes of memory. So David Behrman used that, quite an interesting way in which he used that in Figure in a Clearing, which we'll hear a little bit later today. You're listening to the Calvos and Damian New Music Bazaar on WGDR Plainfield. Let's go to New York and our little talk with David Behrman.
Here in the midst of the Merce Cunningham Dance Collective, we are surrounded by what must be hundreds of automatic plié machines. It's just incredible to watch. And we have a very famous sound technician who is currently touring with Merce Cunningham, and he has assembled these plié machines, and it's just fascinating to watch. You can hear one humming in the background. There, that's it.
It's
a plié machine.
Yes, I can hear it working.
And here in front of us is a collaborator who has done much to further the furtherance.
A collaborator, that sounds... That sounds dangerous to
That's
me.
The
that
type
sounds
of
subversive, in fact.
He did used to subvert. This we will mention later in the program. There is a connection that goes back 27 odd, and odd is
odd.
The correct term, years. It is, in fact, David Behrman. Welcome to the Calvos and Damian New Music Bazaar.
Bazaar. How do you spell that?
B-U-Z-Z-A-R-E.
Bazaar.
Bazaar. Well, bring us up to date. You know, everyone knows the historical David Behrman, I think, but we'd like to know what the live and well David Behrman is doing and thinking.
Assuming you are still alive and it's not just a holographic image.
We were just discussing the fact that we're both still alive, as far as we can tell.
Yeah.
We met
7, I believe, or
127 years
exactly.
ago.
Exactly. In Ohio, an out-of-the-way backwater state, not to disparage it any more than it deserves, and we were both somehow in the composition field, although you were my mentor.
Yes.
Mentor! Oh, let's hear more.
Menthol, I meant. Just a refreshing breath.
It was your mentor.
Menthol.
That's one of the
colleague of Lex
Wagnerian characters. Menthol.
And in those days, you were fiddling about with electronia, and as you mentioned, you had formed the group called the New Music Junta, or Junta, as it was called in Ohio. They couldn't get the pronunciation of the Southwest. And I don't know that I didn't exactly rankle at it, but my cream pie throwing episodes didn't fit in well with some of the other members of the junta. But you were there stalwartly carrying the banner for new music in Ohio.
Very briefly. Very briefly. I remember we did Kosugi's piece once in Ohio with some of the students. We're talking about 1972. And we did your music with the students there. The students did one of those slow pieces where you crinkle paper. Yeah. We're actually in the same room at this very moment as Takahisa Kosugi.
It was a piece of...
We were hoping to get him to join us today, but he decided that he's going to listen because the abuse level is liable to get very high.
As I recall, that was a piece of origami gone very much awry.
Yeah, right. I think it had something to do with... Origami maybe had something to do with it. Yeah, I don't know.
But enough of this gay
badinage. Yeah, badinage indeed. How about the present? What are you doing? You're on a tour, and what does that involve?
At the moment, we're on a tour, and we just did events, which are the dances, fragments of things that are decided that day.
And it is with the Merce Cunningham.
Yeah. I didn't tour with them for 20 years, but this year I've started again.
So describe some of this, the setting, how it works. You said something about on the spot. What do you mean?
The dance is has nothing to do with the music except that they occur at the same time in the same space.
And the music is
the music is liable to be anything that the participants, that the music participants decide on. That day, and there's no cross-checking between the dance.
Do you mean they make up the music, or they choose it from a repertoire, or what do you mean?
Well, they might make a plan that is just not to even discuss what they're going to do, or it might be a plan of dividing up the time.
But where do you come in? Where do you figure in? You just eat the sandwiches that the tour bus, or are you part of the? Are you one of the musicians?
Yeah.
Oh, I see.
Yeah. That's right.
How does it work? I mean, I assume that it sort of has a set time to start. So what happens when the performance begins?
It has a set time to start.
And is that the only determining factor?
And then it lasts usually an hour and a half.
Okay.
And then it stops.
And then it stops.
And so what happens is the dancers only find out what they're going to do that day, but it's parts of the repertory that they've rehearsed.
Okay, yeah.
So there's a large repertory of pieces that have been developed over the years.
Okay,
and
yeah.
Merce chooses from right. parts of that repertory. I don't know, have you ever seen one of these?
Yeah, well, some of his work, yes.
Yeah.
And what about the music then? We're in this acoustic layer here because we're in radio. So there's some way we can translate that into words. Can you describe what
well,
happens?
Well, it varies. Each time is different. For instance, the last one we did on a couple of days ago in Glendale was there were four musicians, Kosugi and Stuart Dempster.
Stuart Dempster. Yes, we played quite a number of his things on the show from that wonderful CD with Pauline Oliveros.
Yeah, right. Yeah. Oh, the deep listening?
Yes.
Right. And John Gibson, you know John Gibson?
Yes.
And me. Mm-hmm. And so we, on Saturday, we just decided, the only thing we decided was that it was a very small pit. It was an old vaudeville theater with a very small pit. And since there were four of us, and there's also a large audio mixer in the pit, which takes up a lot of cubic feet. So Stuart Dempster decided he would not be in the pit at all. He would just rove around in the audience. So he outfitted himself with a... He kind of looked like a woodsman of some unknown culture. He had a kind of a leather bag tied to his waist, and he had a garden hose around his neck and a conch shell in one hand and some mouthpieces and other noise-making. So the only thing we decided in advance was that he would be wandering around. And then John Gibson decided he would join Stuart for part of the time and then come back to the pit.
And what is the sound like? What would we expect to hear in this kind of a circumstance as he winds? He's playing the mouthpiece, he's playing the shell. Stuart Gibson's playing the shell, and what else is happening?
And then, Kosugi was making his music that he does in a variety of wonderful ways, using analog electronics, violin, amplified violin, and vocals. It's an amazing sound that you must hear if you don't already know it.
Okay. Yeah. What do we have a recording that we can of some of it that we can use for the program?
We do. We just have to look around to see which one.
Good.
Yeah, there are various.
Good.
Yeah.
Great.
And then John Gibson plays various wind instruments, saxophone, flute, alto flute, I guess that was it. And then I have the software and interactive situations that the others can join in if they want, but they don't have to.
Mm-hmm. Your software, what are you running it on these days? You're one of the pioneers in that. We'll talk about that.
Yeah, we can talk about it. It's on Macintoshes.
Uh-huh.
And there are not many people who work in the way I do, but there are a few. Do you know Ron Quivola?
Only by name. And I have probably one or two short things on recording somewhere from him. Yes, but I know his name.
Yeah. Well, he's a very interesting artist and composer, and he's also developed a music language called Formula, mm-hmm. which is something like HMSL, mm-hmm. which, of course,
yes. Larry Polansky
and Nick Ditkovsky, I'm sure we'll talk about that. HMSL and Formula are kind of cousins. They're both sitting on top of the general purpose language called Forth, and they're schedulers for music events. They make musical things that would normally be awkward and take a lot of detailed programming easy.
Such as what? Let's give me an example. Of
well, an example, you set up a process in Formula. You set up a process that runs, that does whatever it does, and you write in Forth, but there are these special Formula constructs that are Forth-like, but they're sitting. I guess we shouldn't get too technical.
Well, that's right. Go ahead. Yeah.
They're Forth-like constructs that are sitting there in the software. And you set up a process. Say it's a process to make some percussive sequence of events that's varying in some way according to something that you've set up. You can set that up and put it in, and then it will run independently and not interfere with other processes that could be in a completely different time frame mm-hmm. or tempo.
Mm-hmm.
So it's...
Are you generating the sounds from the computer, or are you controlling another piece of equipment with them at this point, or both?
It's mostly MIDI, not completely. I have some mm-hmm. custom things that are not in the world of MIDI. But a lot of the sound generating stuff is MIDI. And I'm not using the latest generation of things that can run on very fast power PCs. I'm mm-hmm. not doing that yet. The things that, you know, real time processing, DSP, I'm not doing.
All right, let's take a break and listen to something, and then we'll come back. So what's a good thing to choose to listen to get us started on this?
Let's see. Well, this we can be off the air now, right?
Yes, of course. We can be off the air now. So let's go off the air, and then we'll be right back with the example of music from David Behrman, our guest today on the Calvis and Damian New Music Bazaar. Thank you.
I just kept a little more.
Okay. Yeah, he's headed for... Yeah, we'd love some more water. And so we've just heard...
I recognize it. The name is on the tip of my tongue.
Oh, do say. What's the name of the piece?
I can't... I dare not, because it's in a language that escapes me. However... No, I won't.
As we're drinking our fresh water, well, David Behrman is heading back toward the microphone.
The kilt.
He's about to tell us what is it we have just heard.
Part of Interspecies Small Talk is the name of it.
Small Talk.
No wonder you couldn't remember that.
Of course. Now, do you suppose when you go to your next venue, when Merce and you perform in Nashville, that you'll alter the music to incorporate the Nashville sound to more get the audience familiar with the performance?
Maybe something of Nashville will creep into. Actually, we're not doing that piece this year. So,
oh, too bad.
Sorry, but it'll be something else. That,
still, I think it's important that you respond to the audience, as they will respond to you if you just throw in a few things from Dolly Land, I think.
I know. I was hoping that Dolly would come to our performance.
And Jam.
And
I understand
Jam.
She can jam.
Oh, she. I thought you were just talking about Salvador.
Salvador Dolly Land. That's right.
Nice.
That's in Memphis.
Oh, sorry. Sorry.
Do go on.
Oh, I wasn't going on. But let's go back to those Seminole days, as the historians like to talk about.
In Florida?
Seminole days? No. Of early work with microcomputers before the word personal computer was even invented, the days of microcomputers. You were working with what, and what were you doing with it? And bring us up to date.
It's actually over there on the shelf. But since this is radio, there's no point in bringing it over to the microphone. It's called the Kim One.
The famous Kim One.
You can see it over there. It's on that shelf to the right of the yellow folder.
For those of you who...
Standing up against the wall.
Who know about processors, the Kim One was a 6502 microprocessor.
Exactly. How do you know? You're too young.
Oh, no. I have one, too.
You do? You're
yes,
kidding. Really?
With 2K of memory, piggyback.
You do? Oh,
yes.
That's amazing.
And the Kim One actually...
You must be older than I thought.
I'm sorry. I apologize. It was the same processor that was used in the some of the original Apples.
Yeah, the Apple II.
That's
same,
right.
It's
in the same family that gave us the first video games as well. The 6507, which is a related processor, was used
that.
In those very first Pong games.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
And so we're going back quite a ways, and this is a single board machine. For those of you who use large screens now, the display consisted of only a series of numerals.
Right, hexadecimal.
That's right. And there was the information had to be entered by hand, one byte of information at a time.
Mm-hmm.
And out of that, various routines could be created. I'm sort of reminiscing here a bit, but a dear friend and fellow programmer by the name of Philip Hooper and I worked up a situation where we were able to run 7 simultaneous time-shared programs on a Kim One with 2K of memory. So for those of you with 20 megs of memory, you can drool now.
I remember a very exciting day in my life. I decided the memory was too small, so I went out and bought a board of external memory that was 4K. 4K of memory.
4K.
And it cost $300. And it was very exciting to bring that home. And then suddenly I had this vast memory to work with.
So you were doing some very exciting things, though, with this machine. I mean, here you had the very beginnings of computer power, and you had virtually invented out of whole cloth the process of using interactive work with a computer. Tell us about
that. Well, I don't know if I was sort of at the right place at the right time. I was in the Bay Area in the late 70s, mid to late 70s. And there were a group of people there who were doing that. And, I mean, I got advice from people who actually knew more about it than I did. And around Mills College, there were a number of smart people who were using microcomputers. As soon as they got cheap and small, it suddenly became interesting. Lightweight and cheap was the key. Because I remember, actually, in Ohio in 72, it was the first time I ever encountered the computer. And I don't know if you remember, but there were lectures on computer arts. There was a...
Suri.
Suri, Charles
Suri, yes.
Chuck Suri was developing morphing, wasn't
exactly.
it?
Exactly.
It's the beginning of morphing.
Yes, it was pretty dinosaur-like, but he was doing it.
And I remember you could write a program and you'd punch it into cards and you'd take it down to the computer center and then the next day you'd get back your results, which probably had a bug in it. And it was like a huge IBM 370, wasn't it? Or 360?
Exactly.
Yeah.
It was.
So that obviously didn't turn one on musically, that situation. At least not some of us. So by the late 70s, the Kim cost, I guess, $200?
Somewhere in that vicinity, $200, $250. And it was about 1976 that the Kim One appeared.
Yeah.
So it's gosh, 20 years ago we're talking about.
Yes.
Half, less than a generation, and we have seen it gone from these single little boards to these massive machines.
Yes, yeah. It's really amazing.
And so at the time you were creating what with them?
Well, I had homemade synthesizers at that time, and they usually responded to switches changing position to open and close analog switches, maybe, or to change the frequency of an analog oscillator. Or there were digital oscillators also that there were phase-locked loop chips mm-hmm. that took little word inputs that would change their function. So these early microcomputers had output ports, parallel output ports, and you could just attach them to these music devices that existed already, and you could do the changes from a program instead of from a board of hardware or from physical switches. So it was a rather easy step. And maybe it was easier than if I had, for myself, if I had bought commercial synthesizers, which I never did. It would have been harder to connect it with the microcomputer, mm-hmm. but somehow having homemade synthesizers and knowing the electronics and having these switching points made it very simple to attach it to this new device, which is like a smart switch. It was
a smart switch, right.
Yeah.
And it could remember.
It could remember.
Do
yeah.
it again the same
yeah.
way.
Yeah.
Yes.
Right. Yeah.
And you, how did you actually describe some of the music you created with it?
Yeah, there was a piece that's just been reissued on CD by Lovely Music that came out in 78, I guess. It was recorded in 77. It was one of those, it was the first two pieces that I ever did, actually.
Which are called?
Well, one is called On the Other Ocean, okay. and the other is called Figure in a Clearing. Figure in a Clearing was not interactive. That was the very first thing that I ever tried with a Kim. And it was just homemade synthesizers that were switching, that were switched by the microcomputer. And there was the program was just changing time durations, and these switching points where the chords would change. And they changed with a little bit of a delay, so there was a sort of a arpeggio mm-hmm. effect.
Let's listen to one of those.
Yeah, we can play that.
Choose
yeah.
one of those. Which one shall we hear?
Okay, how about a little bit of Figure in a Clearing, which was the very first piece.
Great. Figure in a Clearing. Music 20 years old
now.
Oh,
I should say that it has a, although it wasn't interactive, it was designed to be a sound that happened together with a live performance, and there's a beautiful live performance by David Gibson, who's a wonderful cellist who is a new music composer. And he played, I didn't tell him what to do. That was part of the idea that there was this sound environment that the computer gave. And the only thing, I think the only discussion we had was that I just asked him to use five or six pitches,
mm-hmm.
and not to get faster when the computer rhythm got faster. That was the only communication we had about it. And so he thought about that and he made his own design of what to do. And that was it.
Figure in a Clearing by David Behrman.
Anyone still awake?
We are.
Of course we are.
Of course we are. We have to turn the knobs.
Yeah.
That's Figure in a Clearing, music by David Behrman. We'll finish our interview with David Behrman next week. Just a little piece about the problem of being heard in a society in which the recording is dominant. This is from a book published about 12 years ago called All American Music by the music critic John Rockwell. And he points out that records are more integral than ever to building an artistic reputation. Just as a young instrumentalist cannot hope for an international touring career without frequent recordings, so too a composer, and especially a composer of electronic music so suited to the recording medium, cannot escape provinciality. And he points out even the provinciality of New York City, however that could be, without disc exposure. Take Charles Dodge.
Please.
Yes. He'll be our guest next year.
Oh, good.
He's still promising. Take Charles Dodge, a computer music composer of considerable invention and imagination who doesn't happen to be a very successful hustler. As an unassuming professor of composition at Brooklyn College, in the absence of a regular concert circuit on which new electronic pieces can be heard, he cannot hope for a national reputation unless he can record. During the years in which Teresa Stern, the famous Teresa Stern, ran None Such Records, Dodge was commissioned by the company to create an album-length work called Earth's Magnetic Field, which attracted much favorable attention. But then his recordings receded to the tiny, erratically distributed labels frequented by most other composers. And he goes on to talk about Behrman meeting the same fate in this excellent chapter on David Behrman in All American Music.
Now, I did not mean to denigrate Mr. Behrman or the music at all. It was very restful.
It was.
I started nodding off
it
a bit.
Was. Well, it's very nice. The unfortunately, I would love to have been able to find the tape of the performance he gave of that live in 1977. Unfortunately, it turned out I didn't record it. We needed the machine for playback that night, so we never actually recorded that performance.
But it remains fixed in your memory.
It does remain fixed in my memory, especially the performance being delayed by almost 15 minutes as he tried to get the Kim 1 computer working. It was quite a night. You're listening to the Calvos and Damian New Music Bazaar on WGDR Plainfield.
No space.
No space. Let's listen to another use of electronics, another yet different one. We've heard interactive electronics. We've heard electronics where the composer had to create the language, which was working with the singer in this case. We've heard the modified CD player. How about this one? This is music by Randall Neal. This is a set of variations created by an algorithm which he wrote to develop variations on a tune. So in effect, he is what?
He is what?
He is what?
He is
the catalyst, the... What word would you suggest for this?
Plagiarist comes to mind.
Yes, he's the guy who wrote the program.
Yeah,
and then he stole the tune, which is Old Jack Gilly, and he threw the program at the tune, and it came up with a set of variations. Let's hear it. Here's music stolen, recomposed by the algorithms he wrote by Randall Neal. algorithmic variations on old Jack Gilly, programmed by Randall Neal.
Jack Daniels, you say?
Old Jack Daniels, yeah. Well, there's one way using homemade stuff. In this case, you write your own algorithm to modify the music that already exists. And so it has that kind of familiarity.
Yeah, something you haven't heard before. You can't quite place
can't
it.
Did this
person really write this, or is it just spontaneously combusting somehow?
And, you know, whether or not the sign comes down, and the, what is that? The word of the day? I forget. But Groucho Marx.
Yes, duck comes down, gives you $100.
Right, right. So if you recognize the tune, the duck will come down and give you absolutely nothing.
All right, but give us something else.
How about Marc Batier? This is another way of taking something that exists and changing it around using technology. In this case, a method which is nigh impossible without computer technology, and that's the modification of pitch and duration, character and quality of an original sound to produce an entirely new sound and to build a composition out of it. In this case, the poetry of Henri Chopin, spoken by Henri Chopin, but then taken by Marc Batier and turned and twisted and maneuvered into new shapes and sounds and qualities.
Now, you're assuming that a person doesn't have a nice, good, high-quality Wallensack
I knew
back there.
And a very sharp razor blade.
Yes,
yes.
One could come close. I think our listening audience will agree.
Those with Wallensacks would probably agree.
Yes.
Especially
those
nice monaural Wallensacks where you kind of have to use two of them to achieve this effect. This is, I forget, what is this one we're going to hear? See, I'm so good at this because you've distracted me.
Number 11 will do.
Number 11 will do. Right, thank you. Transparent Landscape.
Yep.
Music by Marc Batier. Thank you.
More.
That's all right, more.
Good stuff.
Transparent Landscape, that music by Marc Batier. And that available on an incredible CD called Transparence on the Bond Age, if you like the middle of the word capital, or Bondage if you don't, CD. Actually not available in America officially, but you can get it from some import outlets. Very good. Transparence, music by Marc Batier. And then another take on what to do is Tobago Fonillo, a piece by Nick Collins, which is described as for trombone-propelled electronics. And this is his own descriptions. The sounds are processed through my trombone-propelled electronics, a digital signal processor that is controlled from the movements of a trombone slide and uses the brass instrument as an acoustically malleable loudspeaker. The initial samples are so short that they are heard only as the resonant drones of stolen waveforms. It gets poetic here. Ready? Yeah. Stolen waveforms sprayed around the room by the highly directional trombone speaker. The pitch of the drone deepens as the samples are lengthened. This texture gives. Oh well, you know, we don't have to hear the rest of it. But that's the thing. Slide and you stick the, you know, speaker
right.
And trombone propelled electronics.
Yes.
Yeah. I know. Here it is. Music by Nick Collins. We won't hear all of it. It's a pretty dandy piece. Worth hearing in its entirety, and we have. Go out and buy it. It's available on Trace Elements. It is available in this country. And cheap.
Yeah.
modulation. How about that?
I didn't hear it. You want to play it again?
No, no, absolutely not. No. And we have in the studio with us Dr. Matt. That's Matt Fields, who will be recording an interview with this evening for broadcast in a couple of weeks. And he did say, yeah, it kind of sounds like what you'd expect with a speaker inside a trombone.
Yes, but eventually someone else will be able to make snide comments about his music.
Ah, yeah, well, we will.
Oh, we certainly
yes,
will.
Yes, absolutely. And let's turn to a pairing here.
O pairing.
A piece by Peter Bales, followed by a piece by Henning Berg. And both these guys do interactive computer programs where the performance is sampled by the computer and a MIDI response is provided. They respectively call their pieces Oscar and Tango. I like those two-syllable friendly names. Yeah, I like them friendly. It's not computer program, it's friendly. Oscar and Tango. And the first one is called The Headless Horseman. That's friendly, too. Music by Peter Bales. And that'll be followed a few minutes later. We won't play the whole thing. By some piece we haven't chosen yet by Henning Berg. Both of them, computers sampling the information and giving a response according to a set of choices programmed into the algorithm. In the case of the Peter Bales, it's that kind of stark European electronic-y kind of sound. In the case of Berg, it's his attempt at reproducing a stark European-y jazz-like sound.
Now, do you suppose the listener could establish his or her own algorithm for listening to these tunes?
Absolutely. The volume control is always available. Which reminds me, and I won't go into it too much, we should have played a little bit of the piece by John Cage and LaJarn Hiller, in which a computer program called Knobs, a printout from that, is provided in each copy, and you get to adjust your volume, bass, treble, and balance according to the Knobs program. But first, Bales and Berg.
Oh, okay.
Sounds like a beverage to me.
Pretty smooth.
That was Landmark, music by Henning Berg, also with John Taylor on piano. That's Berg on the trombone. And Tango doing the improvisatory interpolation.
So he would lead us to believe.
And so, yes, and before that, Peter Bales, the Headless Horseman for Oscar, his interactive music program. Let's listen to a little Brian Reinbolt, this called A Man or a Baby. This is where the person who comes by messes around with the computer keyboard, and it responds to that kind of messing around instead of just doing the pre-programmed stuff that the composer has chosen. In this case, the music is played by the interaction between a non-musician, say. It might be a non-musician or a musician, either case.
So this is not precisely an algorithm unless the composer deems it to be algorithmic. Based on
the algorithmic response to well, what can I tell you? Another way of approaching doing this and trying to find some virtue in it.
Yes.
Music by Brian Reinbolt. Thank you.
Think so?
This is just cute.
Just cute. I think we can pass by the cute, you think?
Yeah, please do. What can you maybe filter in?
Well, finally a piece by David Tudor. And David Tudor, who is from the era, shall we say, as David Behrman, working with unique electronics. And this, like the Behrman, is also for... Ah, there it is. Also for electronics, which he has constructed, as well as purchased commercial electronics and quasi-improvisatory work.
Is it interactive?
It is, in fact.
Do tell.
No, I won't. Let's just listen to it, and let's wrap up the show with the conclusion of Tone Burst by David Tudor. We'll finish up our interview with David Behrman next week at this time. And don't forget to write us on the... website. We have a nice link you can click and send us all your brickbats and praises and such, www.maltedmedia.com, and that's malted as in milk, maltedmedia.com. And we'll see you next week. Hear from you next week. You'll hear from us next week. And?
And what? Oh, there's a show, a concert coming up. Did you announce next?
I did not. Oh,
a Friday concert, the Vermont Contemporary Music Ensemble, next Friday, November 7th.
Playing music of?
A number of folks. Boring Martineau.
Martineau.
John Harbison.
Oh, John Harbison. This is a snorer of a concert, huh?
But coupled by David Gunn.
Oh, good.
To perk up the
perking
audience.
Things up. That's Friday, November 7th.
November 7th at St. Paul's Cathedral in Burlington. It will conclude the premiere of the world of Going Like 60.
And let's go like 25 with Tone Burst.
A production of Multimedia.